Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Listeners, after the historic news that for the first time ever, a former president of the United States has been served a criminal indictment, we wanted to make sure you have a clear picture of what it means and what comes next. So today, you'll hear two conversations. First, you'll hear from a legal expert, a former U.S. attorney with experience dealing with white-collar crimes, the types of crimes that Trump is reportedly facing, about the legal angle and how the court proceedings will proceed. Our guest has also been a judge. And then we'll hear some political analysis, as well as what it means for New York City, where the court proceedings will be held and where Trump seems likely to try to rally his supporters. So on today's podcast, those two long-form conversations on two important distinct angles on the story of the first indictment of a former president. So let's get into it. From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Friday, March 31st. With me now is Zachary Carter, who has experience that's relevant to this every which way. On the prosecution side, he's been the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, which includes Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, and the Long Island counties, Nassau and Suffolk. On the defense side, he is chair of the Legal Aid Society Board of Trustees. On the judicial side, he's been a judge on the criminal court bench in New York and a magistrate judge in federal court. And for good measure, he was New York City's corporation counsel for 5 years. That means he was the top lawyer representing the city of New York. Mr. Carter, thanks for giving us some time this morning. Welcome to WNYC today.
Oh, my pleasure to be here.
So the arraignment and official reveal of the charges is not expected until Tuesday, but do you have reason to believe that they will be something like falsifying business records to cover up the Stormy Daniels hush money payments in order to benefit Trump's 2016 campaign?
Oh, well, that's been the speculation, and based on reporting in terms of the identity of witnesses who have recently appeared before the grand jury, that seems to be a reasonable conclusion.
I cited that stat from the Times about D.A. Bragg bringing that charge, falsifying business records, 117 times since taking office just last year. Can you see that stat having a role in a potential trial?
Well, that stat is not something that's going to come to the attention of the jury. I think the stat should be more important for the media reporting on this case, so that they can that puts things in perspective. I mean, this is the prosecution of a business records case is bread and butter for the white collar prosecutors of the Manhattan DA's office, and combining those charges with a felony that the false business records are intended to support is just not unusual. It's routine.
Well, you say this is not likely to come before the jury, that stat, but would it be potentially needed to negate any potential claim of selective prosecution, a witch hunt defense, if you will, which is what Trump is using so far in the political context?
A witch hunt defense only plays in the court of public opinion. It is not a legal defense. And so it wouldn't be a relevant consideration for the jury.
Well, let me pursue this one step further, because Trump, like anyone else, is innocent until proven guilty. But let's say the evidence is strong on the merits regarding his behavior. Is there any version of a claim of political prosecution that could sway a jury? Is there any history of that in other cases, or would that even be allowed if the evidence proves beyond a reasonable doubt that he's guilty on the merits?
All right. Well, with any case tried to a jury, there are considerations that a jury should take into account that are required by law, that is, in terms of the elements of the offense, as explained by the judge, the standard of proof, understanding of evidence that they're entitled to consider and evidence that they are required to disregard based on the judge's rulings. Those are issues of what the jury's legal obligations are and the instructions they receive. But juries are human beings, and they cannot purge from their knowledge and experience base what they're exposed to in terms of published accounts about cases. And they're not going to disregard their views on the importance and the status of certain persons who may be indicted. So, for instance, in cases involving police officers accused of misconduct against civilians, classically in civil rights cases involving either assaults or other abuse of authority or homicides, every prosecutor with experience in prosecuting those cases knows there's going to be, as a practical matter, an elevated standard by which the lay jurors are going to judge those events. And so you have to prepare to present an even more compelling case than you ordinarily would have if the defendant is a police officer. Here, you're going to have 12 ordinary citizens of New York City who are going to be sitting in judgment in the novel case against the former president of the United States. And you can bet that the jury, perhaps even subconsciously, is going to be applying a somewhat higher standard before they make a decision to convict beyond a reasonable doubt someone who was formerly the president of the United States. And I'm sure that the Manhattan DA's office will have taken that into account in making sure that they have as compelling a case as they could pull together to present to this jury.
But the defense would have to communicate that kind of with a wink or an assumption that the jurors' minds are working in the way that you just described, as opposed to trying to show, aha, this is political because we can show you this piece of evidence that it's political.
I mean, I think some things are so, I think that there are matters that even without a wink, that defense counsel can assume are going to be on the minds of jurors that are reasonably well-informed, you know, who read the newspapers, who are exposed to the news, who are, you know, on social media, that they don't need to make a huge deal about the political implications of this case. Those are apparent. And jurors are going to evaluate this case, frankly, with that in the backdrop. I mean, that's because they're human.
So, Mr. Carter, another thing we're all watching for, as you know, is whether Trump is charged in connection not just with the Stormy Daniels case, but with the crime his company, the Trump Organization, and his CFO, Alan Weisselberg, were already convicted of by a Manhattan jury in a tax evasion case brought by Bragg. Here's a clip of D.A. Bragg on this show just after that conviction, answering my question, why wasn't Trump himself charged in this case if he ran the company, not just Alan Weisselberg?
The defense argued that sort of, you know, everyone else had their head in the sand, including Mr. Trump. Shouldn't say everyone else, but Mr. Trump specifically. And in a rebuttal, you know, we said, look, the former president, this is his namesake corporation. He hired all of these people. He set it in motion. And so to say that, you know, he knew nothing was incredible. Now, that is a significant jump between that and imposing individual criminal liability. I mean, here, Mr. Weisselberg was, you know, like I said, a luxury car, housing, tuition for, you know, a private school for his grandson. And so the evidence, you know, when we make all of our decisions also based on the evidence, as Mr. Weisselberg warranted the charge, and the jury and the judge, you know, agreed.
So that's a little bit of why Bragg didn't charge Trump then. But listen to what he said to me just after that.
What the public should know is that while that team was operating on full display, other members of the team with the same level of integrity and rigor and professionalism, we're working on other strands. And that's the type of representation that the people of the state of New York are getting. And when we're in a position to sort of report out, we will.
Alvin Bragg here on January 16th. Mr. Carter, do you understand that explanation of why Trump wasn't part of that original tax evasion case? And does that second response make you think that could be part of an indictment now, not just the Stormy Daniels hush money cover-up?
Yeah, I agree. I believe that there was never any reason to doubt that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office was not continuing to investigate Donald Trump's personal complicity in the financial fraud case that was brought against the Trump Organization. But again, his guilt would have to be, his complicity would have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that the level of proof that would convince a jury, particularly again in the case of a former president of the United States, is elevated. And I think that it made sense for the Manhattan DA to take whatever time he and his senior people deemed necessary to build the most compelling possible case against Trump. And it's a matter of public record that Weisselberg was a key figure in that case, and that he would be in a position to shed substantial light on whether or not Trump was fully aware of all the financial improprieties that were occurring, whether he was both knowledgeable and also whether or not these things occurred at his direction. And I'm sure that behind the scenes, there's a lot of work put into trying to put Weisselberg in a position where he perceives it to be in his best interest to fully cooperate in an investigation and a prosecution of Mr. Trump. And those things take time.
So it sounds like you wouldn't be surprised to learn on Tuesday, when the charges are revealed, that that's part of it, the tax evasion.
Not at all.
Thinking like a prosecutor, from your experience as U.S. attorney here in New York, what must D.A. Bragg think he has in order to jump into the abyss like this and bring any kind of charges against Trump? I mean, it definitely takes some personal courage. I think we have to give him at very least that, with the safety threats to him and his family personally and his whole team of prosecutors by extension. He does have the discretion, I think, to decide the risks aren't worth it for the specific crimes involved. So I'm guessing he must think he has a slam dunk case of some kind, but I don't know. What do you think, as a former prosecutor, that D.A. Bragg must have weighed in his mind before deciding to go through everything he's about to go through?
I started in the prosecution business 50 years ago. And I can say that I have never met a prosecutor, state, federal, local, who has taken into account in making a decision whether to prosecute or not their personal safety or that of their family. That's just kind of baked into the cake when you are a prosecutor. That's something that that I think you accept that there may be risk, but I think that people generally plow ahead and notwithstanding those risks and do what they think the evidence dictates. Some prosecutors may be affected by other kinds of considerations, but in terms of personal safety, I've never known a situation in which someone decided not to bring a case because they were afraid to do so.
Do you think the personal safety implications are extraordinary in this case, however?
They are extraordinary because obviously this particular defendant has shown no inhibition about inspiring violence in his devoted followers, as evidenced by January 6th And the fact that he has doubled down on exhorting his, you know, his minions to protest vigorously in the event of his indictment. So those risks, you know, the risk of public safety certainly are elevated. But, you know, I mean, prosecutors prosecute, you know, violent drug cartels and organized crime figures, too. So there are always those risks. But this situation, I agree, is unique. I mean, when you have the cheerleader for violence being the former president of the United States, that's different, and certainly something that would cause you to focus attention.
One more thing on that, and then we're going to go to some phone calls. People have a whole host of observations and questions, as you might imagine. Trump has already posted a Photoshop picture of himself taking a baseball bat to the district attorney's head, and Trump has said if he's indicted, there will be death and destruction. Do you think Trump might have committed any additional crimes with any of those posts?
Well, it's my expectation that that is a matter that would be under investigation.
Let's take a phone call. Anthony in Killingworth, Connecticut. You're on WNYC with former judge, former prosecutor, current chair of the Legal Aid Society, Zachary Carter. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, how are you?
Hi,
I just was talking to your person. Good morning, Your Honor. I would like to say that I totally agree with you about hoping that Alvin Bragg has a slam dunk case. I was a police officer for 24 years, and I think that most of the prosecutors and ADAs that I dealt with were one of the primary considerations was, is the case winnable? But aside from that, there was a tidbit in the Times, I believe, last week, where they spoke about Alan Weisselberg jettisoning his legal team that was supported by the Trump Organization. And there was speculation in the article that he could be testifying to this grand jury. We might not know about it because as a prisoner at Rikers, he'd be coming in a very private entrance. There'd be no public fanfare, and it's not observable to the public. And he, as the former CFO, would have intimate knowledge of all of these payments and who knew about them and the rationale for them. And I was just curious that, you know, maybe he's divulging things that would corroborate Michael Cohen's allegations, and he's a much more credible witness, if you will, especially for public opinion and for the court and a trial.
I agree with you on all counts. The fact that Weisselberg is currently in detention certainly means that the media that has been kind of laying outside and wait for observation of witnesses coming in out of the building where the grand jury is held, that would not be something that they could monitor. So that's a very interesting point. You know, part of the process of trying to encourage witnesses to cooperate is very often to communicate to the extent that you can, consistent with, you know, with ethical restrictions. Helping these prospective witnesses understand that they should be represented by counsel who have their personal best interests at heart and their interests only, and are not working primarily for persons who are under investigation as opposed to the witness. So you would want to be represented by someone whose undivided loyalty is to you, that is to Mr. Weisselberg, and not to Donald Trump or to the Trump Organization. So you can expect that those kinds of conversations have been had with Mr. Weisselberg, but it's going to be up to him ultimately as to who he retains as counsel, and it's going to be up to that counsel to decide, as he or she should, whether or not they're going to act in the best interest of Mr. Weisselberg and Mr. Weisselberg alone, and not be influenced by the fact that it's possible that their fees may be paid by the Trump Organization.
Huh. And it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, that Weisselberg did not in any formal way, as some defendants sometimes do when there's a person up the chain from them who might also potentially be charged, did not actually enter into some kind of deal to cooperate with prosecutors in this case regarding Trump, correct?
As I understand it, that is correct. And that is almost always a reflection of the amount of practical leverage that a prosecutor has over a prospective witness. That it really, whether or not a witness feels compelled to enter into a cooperation agreement, more often than not is determined by whether or not they believe that the prosecutor has sufficient evidence to assure their conviction and sentencing for an offense that they're concerned about.
What do you think it's like for Alan Weisselberg at Rikers, by the way? We know how rough it is there for the average person who has to spend time on Rikers. Here's this, you know, rich white guy, rich old white guy. Does he kind of special private cell or wing, or what's it like for Alan Weisselberg at Rikers Island, as far as you could tell, as former New York City Corporation Counsel or in any of your other roles?
Right. Well, I mean, I have no inside knowledge as to any special arrangements that the Department of Corrections would have made to provide for his safety. I mean, the corrections officials make individual determinations all the time based on the nature of the charges for which defendants have been convicted and sentenced. You know, age, health, you know, gang affiliations, for instance, all those sorts of things are taken into account. But it's kind of hard to imagine that for a person who probably, given his line of work, never expected in his wildest imagination to be spending a day in his life in any jail or prison, that this isn't an extraordinarily stressful situation. That most reasonable people would not want to see prolonged. And if the DA is in a position to bring additional charges within the statute of limitations against Mr. Weisselberg, that could result in an extended term of imprisonment beyond what he's already serving, that could certainly focus the mind and encourage more vigorous cooperation with Manhattan DA's office.
Yeah. But also, I mean, most New Yorkers would not want to see him get special treatment. Do you think he's getting special treatment?
I think most New Yorkers, when you think about the plight of people detained at Rikers, would want any prisoner to be detained in an environment that's safe for them. So I don't know if it's an issue of special treatment, but he's entitled to be safe from harm. I have no idea beyond that what the terms of his confinement would be at Rikers.
Gary in Queens is calling, having been hearing some reasons why Bragg's case might be weak against Donald Trump. Gary, thanks for calling in. You're on WNYC with Zachary Carter.
Hi, Brian. Mr. Carter. I don't defend Trump. In fact, I wrote an article, an anti-Trump article recently, but 2 weeks ago, I wrote an article showing how this case with Bragg, which has like three flaws in the case, is on purpose. It's a weak case. They want to energize his base because they want to catapult Trump to the nomination. And what's going to happen is already happening now. His polls are going up. talk show hosts, which you don't listen to, but I do, all over the country. I have an internet radio. They're saying every competitor to Trump, including DeSantis, must support him now.
Wait, Gary, first let me say that I listen to all kinds of shows. I have the internet too, and from all kinds of points of view on radio and television. But are you arguing, Gary, just so we're clear on this, are you arguing that this is a political prosecution, but for the sake of helping Trump become the Republican nominee because Alvin Bragg and other Democrats think he'll be weak?
Let me finish the scenario. The answer is yes. That's the backstory. But what's going to happen next year is that Trump will be indicted for obstruction in the Mar-a-Lago documents case. That's a good case, and he'll deserve to be prosecuted for that. But after that, when that happens, all of these competitors are on board with Trump, and their credibility will be eroded. That sounds like a conspiracy theory that may not be likely, but everything is falling into place right now. I could give you other examples.
I'm going to leave it there, Gary. I appreciate that. So on his main point, I don't know. I didn't think that's where he was going to go. That sounds really far-fetched to me, Mr. Carter, but how about you?
I think it's I'm not inclined to believe in conspiracy theories. I have to respect those who tend to think that way. I think that there are just certain forces, right? There's a certain momentum of events that have inevitable consequences without people having to conspire and contrive certain outcomes. So as a natural result, as a consequence of Trump being indicted, there are people who are going to react in various ways to that indictment. There are core supporters of Trump who are going to be inspired to even more fiercely support him. And there are obviously going to be negative consequences for large numbers of potential supporters who may think that they can do better than having a person under indictment as their preferred candidate for president of the United States. I don't think there are people in any prosecutor's office who are conspiring behind the scenes to try to manage a prosecution in a way that has a particular political outcome one way or the other. I think these outcomes are just a natural consequence of an investigation and prosecution.
Mr. Carter, you've been a New York criminal court judge. Do we already know who the judge will be for whatever charges D.A. Bragg is bringing? And would it be the same on arraignment on Tuesday as if it goes all the way to trial?
I am not personally aware of who the judge is who's been assigned. I saw a news report yesterday in which, on the basis of some reporting, someone opined that it might be the judge who presided over the trial of the Trump Organization. But I don't know if that's true or not.
Considering the political and media circus that's beginning to be unleashed and that presumably is going to intensify in Lower Manhattan, what do you see as some unique challenges for the judge in this case, or does all of that not really bleed over to anything that would happen from the bench?
I think the judge's highest priority in a case like this is to shield the jury and prospective jurors in the jury selection process from outside influences to the maximum extent possible. That's the challenge in any high profile case, and this will be an uber high, obviously profile prosecution. So that will be the greatest challenge.
What about in the scenario for the judge, if Trump incites people to violence on his behalf, if it appears that that is happening to the bench?
I think that most judges that I have had the privilege to appear before, has had as colleagues, who I've known over the years, would land on Donald Trump like a ton of bricks if he were to engage in activities that were calculated to gin up potentially violent protest outside the courthouse. I think the consequences for Mr. Trump, the potential consequences would be sufficiently severe that if he has wise counsel, that they would strongly counsel him against taking any such steps.
But what would the judge have to see in order to say something? Because we know that Trump has a long history of walking right up to that line in his language. I think he's very careful with his language in this respect to preserve some plausible deniability for himself, right? So like he called all those people to Washington for January 6th, will be wild, everything like that. But also said at one point, go peacefully. In this case, he can say, I didn't predict that there'll be death and call for there to be death and destruction. I predicted that there'll be death and destruction. That's different. So where's that line in terms of where the judge would be justified in stepping in?
Well, I think that because of Trump's prior acts, particularly in his role in inspiring his followers to violence on January 6th, that the possibility of his being able to rely on some plausible deniability diminishes with every statement he makes in which he attempts to be, as my father would call it, two-bit slick, in terms of trying to weasel word a statement to his followers that he can subsequently claim was not really intended for the purposes that it seemed. I think those days are over for Donald Trump. I think that any reasonably competent judge will see through that and will communicate a pretty strong message to Trump. That any attempts that he makes to create an atmosphere in which witnesses, court personnel, prospective jurors, sitting jurors are intimidated will not be tolerated.
All right. And as the terms weasel word and two-bit slick make their debuts on the show from the
New terms of art.
That's right, from Zachary Carter. Michelle in, is it Campbell Hall, New York? You're on WNYC, Michelle. Hello.
Yes, it's Campbell Hall.
Where's that? I actually don't know where that is.
Campbell Hall's in Orange County, so it's on, if you take New Jersey Transit, it's actually on the Port Jervis line. There's a stop there.
Gotcha.
Near, like, Harriman, Tuxedo, that kind of place.
Yep, okay. My apologies to the people of Orange County for not knowing that part of the area. Go ahead, Michelle.
Well, first of all, thanks for taking my call. And I just had a question with respect to how Donald Trump will be addressed. Because the charges are prior, or the actions are prior to when he was elected. So it's really Donald Trump who is being, you know, who is taken to task for this, not former President Donald Trump. And I think the, you know, distinguishing the before, the pre, and the post is important, because if he's referred to as former President Donald Trump or President Donald Trump, it will kind of color the jury's perspective of him. So I'm just wondering, what type of language do you think will be used when he is actually in the courtroom? Will it be Donald Trump? Because that's who they're really after, or former President Donald Trump, which gives him, you know, some level of importance.
Right. Interesting. Including from the bench, I guess, Judge Carter.
Oh, no, including and especially from the bench. My guess is that any experienced trial judge who tries to neutralize, you know, any irrelevant, references to status in the course of a trial of a defendant who, you know, who is occupied some, you know, some high office will simply refer to him and insist that everybody else refer to him as Mr. Trump.
Under New York's bail law, much in the news for other reasons, many nonviolent crimes don't require bail to be posted. Would you as a judge be allowed or required to set bail for Trump here?
No. I think that the likelihood is that he would be released on his own recognizance.
And then what? Will he be allowed to leave the state, go back to Florida to live as the case proceeds?
I mean, technically, in any criminal case, a judge, as part of setting down the conditions of pretrial release of detention, sets out the geographic boundaries of where a defendant can travel. It's hard for me to imagine that a judge would set any limits on Donald Trump's travel, particularly because it's. I mean, you can't ignore the elephant in the room, and that is he is a presidential candidate, and that he, as part of his of that status, will be ordinarily required to travel all over the United States in order to campaign. And I don't think that any judge would do anything that unnecessarily made that an issue or an unnecessary distraction in the case. So mm-hmm. I doubt there'll be any limits on his travel.
One more call for you, then we're going to switch guests and continue with our coverage of the indictment of Donald Trump. Joe in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, you're on WNYC with Zachary Carter. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I had two comments that I wanted to make to the general topic. The first is the Republican response to say that this is outrageous or unprecedented, when the underlying reality is what's unprecedented is a president or presidential candidate who has been so chronically and demonstrably truth averse. This crime involves alleged deception for a purpose, and it fits the Donald Trump playbook perfectly as to the behaviors that he's engaged in for his entire professional life.
Right, but you can't bring that into court, or can you, Judge Carter?
Interesting. There may be an extent to which prosecutors could proffer some prior bad acts of Trump that reflect on his credibility. That would seek to bring to the jury's attention other similar circumstances in which he has made provably false statements, and a judge could consider permitting that evidence as proof, not of propensity to lie, but of Donald Trump's a state of mind, his whether or not he has made a knowing and intentional false statements. So there could be a situation in which his prior incidents in which he has made provably false statements could become relevant.
Former U.S. attorney in New York, former criminal court judge in New York, former top lawyer or corporation counsel, as they call it, for the city of New York, and current board chair of the Legal Aid Society, Zachary Carter. Thank you for bringing all your experience and wisdom to the coverage of this. Thank you very much.
Okay. Good to be here.
We'll continue with coverage of the indictment of Donald Trump, this historic moment, with Errol Lewis, New York Magazine columnist, host of Inside City Hall on Spectrum News New York 1 at 7 o'clock on the weeknights, and a lawyer himself. Thanks for some time this morning, Errol. I'm sure you're slammed for your own news organizations. I didn't even mention CNN, where you contribute. You were on this morning. Welcome back to WNYC.
Glad to be with you, Brian. A big, big day.
Have you been down to the courthouse personally since Trump first posted a few weeks ago that he was about to be arrested and called for protests to begin?
I've passed by there a couple of times, and of course I've done lots and lots of hits. We've had almost continuous reporting from down there where I'm talking with one of my colleagues who's down there. So I both passed through and talked with people who were there on camera and asked them what was going on as well. It seems like quite a scene.
I see that the NYPD is calling every officer to report today in uniform, if I read this story correctly. Did you see that? And do you understand what
Yes.
the police commissioner is doing and why?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, sure. This is a very easy device that the commissioner can employ, which is asking everybody to show up, even if you're, say, a detective, even if you're in an investigative or an anti-crime unit, even if your only assignment was to come in and do some paperwork. The commissioner can ask you to show up in uniform. And what that contributes to is something that the mayor and the police commissioner sometimes refer to as omnipresence. When you start realizing how many people actually work for the police department, 35,000 cops and another 15 odd thousand civilians. If the cops all show up in uniform, it looks like there's just uniforms everywhere. And it's a pretty easy way to send a signal to anybody who might be thinking about civil disobedience or actual violence down near the courthouse, that the NYPD is going to outnumber you, out-strategize you, and ultimately outfight you if it comes to that.
Well, I think Hugh in Manhattan has a question. Hugh, you're on WNYC with Errol Lewis. Hi there.
Oh, hi. I can't believe I got on. Thank you. Yes, I was wondering if the judge would have any power to limit the kinds of things he can say. They've just been absolutely on right-wing radio and everything outrageous about Bragg being bought by George Soros. They're claiming he didn't actually, you know, pose for those pictures with a baseball bat. Is there any limitation that can be put on what he can say once he's been arraigned and all that? Because
that's a great question, Hugh. I mean, the judge's discretion and power to control what people say really kind of stops on the courthouse steps, meaning, you know, you can say whatever you want on the steps. You have a First Amendment right to make any kind of accusation. However, once you come in that courtroom, it gets really, really different. And when outrageous remarks that are made on the courthouse steps find their way into motion papers, and we saw a little bit of this in some of the election cases that the Trump campaign or its remnants have been involved in, the judges, the courts get very, very stern. I mean, you know, you can accuse Alvin Bragg of taking money from George Soros or whatever. But you start putting that in motion papers, they get very, very strict about not having the record polluted with those kind of statements. Well, beyond that, if the counsel or the defendant himself, Donald Trump, wants to characterize or even mischaracterize what went on in the courtroom, the judge can give a warning to the lawyers if it's really outrageous or very far off the mark. But beyond that, there's quite a lot of latitude. You know, I mean, what I tell my journalism students all the time is that what people say on the courthouse steps could be anything. You know, how many times have we heard people say, we're going to appeal this, we're going to appeal this to the Supreme Court, and then they never even file the papers?
Yeah,
I mean, that's true of Donald Trump himself, as a matter of fact. So there's going to be a lot of noise, and there's not a lot we can do about it, nor the judge.
Speaking of what might be an idle threat, you probably saw that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis tweeted that he would not assist in the prosecution of Donald Trump. Does that set up a scenario where Trump could refuse to appear in court for an arraignment this Tuesday and DeSantis could refuse to extradite him?
Yeah, they might want to play out some of that comedy verbally. But, you know, one of the beautiful things about our Constitution, Brian, is that you can always learn something new about it. So I did not realize that there is a provision, Article 4 of the United States Constitution, that speaks directly to this issue, that if somebody is charged with a felony in one state and that person happens to be in another state, the governor of that second state shall, and shall means it's mandatory. It's not a lot of room to wiggle room there, shall produce him. So, you know, the governor of Florida can feed his followers all kinds of lies and misrepresentations. But in the end, to the extent that, let's say there is a challenge to the extradition of Donald Trump from Florida to New York, he will have to produce him. I mean, it's like you have to check a piece of paper and that's as far as it goes. If he wants to pretend he's going to try and, you know, hide out in Mar-a-Lago and the governor's going to send Florida state troopers there to protect the compound or anything like that, that's fantasy land. That's just not going to happen. I mean, barring an outbreak of madness that would lead the governor of Florida to openly defy the U.S. Constitution. But I don't think that's going to happen. The two men are political rivals in the end. And so I think they're both just making noises about what might or might not happen. Trump's not going to let, politically speaking, he's not going to let DeSantis become his protector. And DeSantis, in any event, does not have the power. It's specifically denied him under the U.S. Constitution to become Trump's protector when it comes to extradition. So I think we're going to see him here on Tuesday or some other day.
And DeSantis, as I understand it, is a Harvard-trained lawyer. You went to Harvard. Maybe the Alumni Association should get together and send Ron DeSantis a copy of Article 4.
But you know what? Let me just say something, because Mike Pence is a lawyer, too. There are a lot of people who are attorneys, who have legal training, who know better. And they go out and they make the most outrageous statements. It's been kind of hard to swallow, I got to be honest with you. I mean, to see Mike Pence, you know, acting as if, oh, this is an abuse of authority. I heard, you know, the vice president was on television last night saying, oh, this is just a campaign finance case. It very much is not a campaign finance case. It is the tail end of a long running series of civil and criminal cases against the Trump Organization, the leaders of the Trump Organization, and now Donald Trump himself. They've got jury. I mean, a jury found them guilty, the Trump Organization, of criminal tax fraud going back 15 years.
Yeah.
And this is really, in some ways, just a step beyond that. They have falsified records repeatedly. It's been found in court over and over and over again at Trump University, at the now dissolved Trump Foundation. It's really outrageous to try and imagine that this is just about one payment to a porn star right before the 2016 election. It's about much, much more than that.
Ah, well, I asked Zachary Carter this earlier. It sounds like your take is a little more aggressive, if that's the right word, on the question of whether the charges, once they're revealed on Tuesday, will be just about the hush money cover-up, or if they'll also have something to do with the tax evasion case that the Trump Organization and CFO Alan Weisselberg were convicted of.
Well, at a minimum, I think that some of what they may have turned up in the course of that criminal conviction of the Trump Organization is going to be relevant. You know, you got to keep in mind, Alvin Bragg was he worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office in the criminal division, and he focused on money laundering, bank fraud, witness tampering, fraud relating to government contracts. He knows white collar crime really, really well, and has sent a lot of people to prison for violating our very strict laws. And then, you know, again, I think it's important, Brian, that we not define deviancy down or just get used to the idea that, oh, sure, of course, Donald Trump for decades committed, you know, a criminal and civil fraud, and everybody knew that. Well, yeah, we kind of knew that. But, you know, when you have to settle, you know, to the tune of $25 billion in the Trump University case, or you have to dissolve your charitable foundation because of rampant fraud, or you've been found guilty for behavior going back 15 years of criminal tax fraud. There's this $250 million suit that's going on now. It's scheduled to go to trial. The one that the state attorney general has going against the Trump Organization, Donald Trump himself and his three oldest children. That's supposed to go to trial in January, right around the time of the Iowa caucuses. I mean, you know, it's kind of crazy to act as if, you know, people think that this one payment, which is, you know, the latest in a long, long, long line of both proven and suspected and alleged misconduct by this man and his company. This is not an outlier. You know, I think we've got a pattern here, Brian. I think we've got a pattern of bad behavior here, and I think the jury's going to hear about it, and I think it's going to be very hard for him to win that case.
Stephen in Harlem, you're on WNYC with Era Lewis. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to acknowledge the historic nature of yesterday. I feel that that is a date which will be etched, and it's a culmination. A few years ago, I called and said, when Trump was doing all kinds of crazy stuff, I said, this is the beginning of the end of democracy. I still think it's a possibility. Your guest is awesome. You are awesome. That's all I had to say. The historic nature. I think he can skate like Teflon Don. He can get away with it again. But it's in the record now for eternity.
Stephen, I'm glad you called up with this, because in fairness, we've been focusing on what you could call legal minutiae and, you know, political environment of what's about to take place. But it is such a historic moment. Errol, I'm curious, what kinds of feelings are you having about the importance of this first for the United States, a first indictment of a president or former president for anything, for better or worse?
Well, you know, two thoughts, Brian. The first is that it really is remarkable, because there's a certain amount of misconduct that you and I have seen in our adult lifetimes where, you know, look, Richard Nixon was never criminally charged. He was not even impeached. Bill Clinton was impeached, but he was never criminally charged. This is new territory. This has never happened before. Donald Trump was impeached twice, but even he had not been criminally charged until now. That's one thought. The second thought is that there were so many firsts, and not all of them were negative firsts with Donald Trump. We'd never elected anyone to the presidency who had never run for office before, had never served in government before, had never served in the military. And I'm thinking today, among other things, it's like, well, yeah, maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe there's a reason you don't want somebody to start at the top when it comes to governing this country. Maybe we need people to sort of show their stuff in a different kind of a way, so that what are, you know, commercial standards in this case, suspect commercial standards, or even perhaps even criminal commercial standards, are not imported wholesale into the government at the top of the government. Because what you'll get is what we've seen, which is a lot of chaos, and now the spectacle of a former president being booked and arraigned in Manhattan. I mean, nobody should want that, and we couldn't have expected it, because again, we're breaking new ground. But I think it's a warning for the future and something for everybody to really reflect on.
Yeah, and about this taking place in Manhattan, the defense may well bring a motion to move the case out of Manhattan, I would imagine. Can Trump get a fair trial in a county where he only got 12% of the vote in 2020?
That's a great question. That's a great question. I don't know if, you know, look, we've seen Donald Trump use delaying tactic. That's partly why this particular incident, which happened in 2016, 2017, is only being addressed now, years later. He might well think that he could get a better hearing or a different outcome by going to a different jurisdiction. But I'm not so sure about that, to be honest with you. I mean, the facts, we'll know for sure when the indictment is unsealed, but the facts as we believe they're going to be presented are not going to fall easily on the ears of an upstate juror or jurors. Urban, rural, upstate, downstate. I don't think anybody's going to be real happy about the idea of a powerful leader, paying essentially hush money and then lying about it. I mean, all of these things that we've kind of gotten used to or inured to, calloused about here in New York City, I think people are going to maybe be freaked out elsewhere in the state if Donald Trump tries. Because look, essentially, a part of his defense could be, I'm just doing what business people do. And in, you know, I don't know, in Syracuse or in Buffalo or in Rochester or up in the North Country or the Southern Tier, I think people are going to say, really? This is the norm? I wouldn't advise it. But, you know, I've never been in Donald Trump's shoes, so I'm not sure.
It's a great thought experiment that I don't think we'll have a chance to see play out in reality. But how would this go for Donald Trump up in at least Stefanik country, in my beloved Adirondacks? maybe not so well, you know, with the kind of conservative family values that as defined by conservatives.
Only in New York City can a transaction like, oh, yeah, so then I had my lawyer, you know, write a $130,000 check to keep my mistress quiet. You know, in New York, that can kind of come and go. But, you know, out in the real world, including a lot of New York State.
Yeah,
I think that's going to be considered a very unusual transaction.
Well, whether it's in Manhattan or anywhere else, how would you expect jury selection to go in that regard? What kinds of questions will the lawyers ask in a context where everybody already has a preformed opinion about Donald Trump in some way?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I think we saw some of this down in Fulton County, Georgia. One of the things that we in the media have to acknowledge from time to time, and jury selection is one of those times when you have to recognize it, is that a lot of people are really not following these things that we talk about every day. Mm-hmm. So I think it would probably be dismayingly easy to find 12 jurors in New York State who have no opinion or particular knowledge about any of this.
Interesting.
It's a big wide world and people have other concerns.
Errol, before you go, some breaking news this morning relevant to the politics of this. And this kind of surprises me that Alvin Bragg even issued any kind of public response to the Republican pro-Trump politics. But I'm reading from Politico now. Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg defended his office's decision to indict Donald Trump in a letter to Republican lawmakers today, rejecting GOP accusations of political persecution as, quote, baseless and inflammatory. Here's a little more of the quote. That conclusion is misleading and meritless. It's uncharted territory for the legal system. Let's see if this is all a quote. Well, the parts that I read are a quote. It says the letter was sent a day after Bragg's office acknowledged it had issued the first ever indictment of a former president. I guess for all that we and a lot of other people are saying, we have to separate the law from the politics here. Why do you think Bragg is even bothering to respond to Republican politicians who, let's face it, are calling him all kinds of things? Donald Trump Jr. compared him to Pol Pot yesterday. But why does Alvin Bragg dignify any of that with a response?
Well, because in this case, it's coming from Congress and they're asking for documents. And when Congress starts asking for documents, what comes right behind that is a subpoena. And those subpoenas can be delivered in circus-like fashion where they try and serve papers on him and otherwise just really disrupt the entire proceedings. And so I think of this in part as Alvin Bragg doing what he should do, which is protecting the integrity of the state courts from outside interference by federal politicians, federal legislators. The other part of it is I think could be attributed to or described as the education of Alvin Bragg. This is the first office he's ever run for. You and I have talked about this, Brian. He certainly got caught on the back foot and was taken by surprise by the political response to his day one memo when he was just, you know,
on crime, from his point of view, crime in Manhattan.
On crime and prosecuting misdemeanors. I mean, he talked about it on the campaign trail. He said he was going to do it. And then he naively walks into office and starts doing it. And there was this enormous national political outcry. So I think he now realizes, or the people around him have convinced him, that you can't wait for this to happen. You've got to push back. You've got to fight back. I read the letter that you're describing. He's got the facts and the law on his side, you know, easily. And, you know, what what they are trying to do out of these congressional committees is just make political hay out of the situation, probably raise some money for their campaign accounts on the side, and otherwise just kind of disrupt the proceedings. The letter also says, which I think is very telling and quite true, that some of these members of Congress, these Republican members, are acting more like defense counsel. They're asking for confidential papers. They're trying to get inside the investigation, clearly so that they can convey it to Donald Trump. It's utterly improper, and Bragg is absolutely right to push back.
So one final thing before I let you go. You and I have both interviewed Alvin Bragg any number of times. He has previously had, I think it's fair to say, and people should remember this, a reputation as a cautious prosecutor with respect to Donald Trump. You remember he even had assistant district attorneys resign last year because he seemed to be dropping a Trump investigation they were working on. One of them, Mark Pomerantz, even wrote a book about that. So would you say Bragg has been cautious when it comes to deciding to prosecute Donald Trump? And that's an important thing to keep in mind as context here.
You know what? I would substitute for the word cautious. I would substitute the word methodical. You know, he's dogged. He's determined. I think of it as more like, you know, in football, there are people who do flashy plays and try and throw 80-yard passes. And then you have people who do 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Alvin Bragg is taking the ball. He's running it 3 yards. Then you wait. Then you run it another 3 yards. And then you wait. And I think over time, that has proven to be the right way to deal with this unusual intersection between commercial criminal activity and an elected official. And I would also, you know, going back to Bragg's resume, since we're talking about him, he also prosecuted misconduct by elected officials. He was in the public integrity unit in the Attorney General's office. So he actually understands this stuff a lot better, certainly than Mark Pomerantz, and better than a lot of the, I think, the pundits who are criticizing him. He knows how you do a public integrity prosecution, and he knows a whole lot about white collar crime. And you lay them next to each other and you just methodically assemble the pieces. And once you've done that and you put it in front of a jury, he's managed to do something nobody else has done. Lots of people have come after the Trump Organization. Only one person has gotten a criminal conviction, as far as I know, and that's Alvin Bragg.
You mean an indictment?
Well, I'm not.
Oh,
talking about the
Trump Organization, the company. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. I mean, he really does know what he's doing. I mean, you know, I know there's something out there where people somehow think that, you know, I don't know where people get this idea that Harvard law graduates are a bunch of bumbling incompetents. But he is not that. He's a very good, methodical lawyer. And I think if he has the facts and the law on his side, it's going to be really quite a case.
Well, if anybody thinks Harvard Law isn't politically diverse, we've established in this segment that they produce both Alvin Bragg and Ron DeSantis. So we will leave that as a final thought with Errol Lewis, New York Magazine columnist and host of Inside City Hall, weeknights at 7 on Spectrum News New York 1. Errol, thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.